Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
We are coming back to Atlanta right now. Whoa. Mark your calendars, because the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
School of Humans. This episode discusses historical events that include physical and sexual abuse against children. Like the rest of the South, Alabama is a study in contradictions. A region known for both warm hospitality and gross injustice, swelling with pride and stricken by conscience. It's a tangle of racial, economic, and geographic disparities. Lots of America can be like this, sure, but Alabama's complication is legendary. On one hand, the state is deeply conservative, teeming with good old boys and Confederate flags. While most of the nation is celebrating the Martin Luther King holiday each January, Alabama celebrates King Lee Day instead, a joint observation of Martin Luther King and Robert E. Lee. So you'd be forgiven for thinking that a state with this much of a racist history would be pretty white. But Alabama is not a white state. I say this as a Black Southerner myself. For me and my family, and over half of Black people in America, the South is home. Over a quarter of Alabama's residents are Black, almost twice the national average. And Alabama has the fifth highest Black population of any state in the country. In the 1960s, the state's Black population was even larger. But you wouldn't have known that looking at the crowd that surrounded Alabama's Capitol on January 14, 1963, to see George Wallace sworn in as governor. After an unsuccessful run as a moderate in 1958, Wallace triumphed 4 years later, in part by promising never to integrate the state. It was during this inauguration speech that Wallace made a defining statement of the era.
Segregation now, segregation tomorrow, and segregation forever.
White people have maintained power in Alabama, not just back then, but today as well, thanks to the law. It's easy to think of the law as being an objectively moral force, one that is overwhelmingly fair and equal. But the law isn't objective, nor is justice blind. And the rule of law is not about fairness or consistency. It's about power. The law mutates and remolds itself to serve those who enforce it, who make it, and who benefit from it. Everyone else is at its mercy. And no one knows that more than Black people in Alabama. I say that to remind you that the children we're talking about in this podcast were technically, legally criminals. The law had made that determination, and so that's what they were. Juvenile delinquents. Negro lawbreakers. Never mind that the laws that they were breaking were laws designed for them to break. Implemented so that the state could deem them criminals. These were children, often as young as 10 or 11 years old. Suffering trauma from being separated from their loved ones, taken from their families, and handed over to the state. They were children, but to the state of Alabama, they were criminals all the same. That is the Alabama that Lonnie Holly, Jenny Knox, Johnny Bodley, and Mary Stevens, as well as countless other young black children, grew up in.
We have viewed with dismay the tragically slow pace of the Negro's progress toward full emancipation in the state of Alabama, enforced by the demagoguery of the racist forces in the machinery of government.
These incidents in Alabama were caused by outsiders who came to this state seeking trouble.
I felt that I was not being treated right and that I had a right to retain the seat that I had taken as a passenger on the bus.
The federal officers are armed with a proclamation from President Kennedy urging the governor to end his efforts to prevent two Negro students from registering at the university.
We are committed to a worldwide struggle to promote and protect the rights of all who wish to be free.
You are ordered to disperse, go home, or go to your church. This march will not continue.
Montgomery, Alabama, in the 60s, was the most segregated place on the planet.
That's Denny Abbott, a former juvenile probation officer. If you look up Mount Meigs, one of the first things that pops up is a book called They Had No Voice, written by Denny. In it, he tells the story of the 11 years he spent working for Montgomery County Juvenile Justice System as a probation officer. He's a big part of our story, as you'll find out later. When telling us about his childhood, he told us that his father was an out-and-out racist.
I heard the N-word every day from him. In fact, I think my father was a member of the Klan, quite frankly.
And growing up, Denny lived a very segregated life.
Elementary school, middle school, high school, and college, I never went to school with a black person. Not once. Didn't know the name of a black person until I started working after I graduated from college. So I really had no information about the black community because everything was segregated.
After graduating from Huntington College in 1961, Denny found himself married and broke. He was just 21, and he needed a job, any job.
I found out about an opening as a probation officer with the Montgomery Juvenile Court.
His title was actually boys counselor, and interesting, and actually what I find kind of disturbing, euphemism for probation officer.
I was one of like 7 or 8 probation officers there.
And just a few weeks into his job, he had to drive a black child to Mount Meigs for the first time.
What I saw driving up to the institution were black kids working in the fields, and they were wearing army fatigues, old cast-off army surplus pants and shirts that were much too large for them. They had to roll them up. Most of the kids were barefooted, and that's what they did from sun up to sundown, work in the fields. And then I got to see a couple of the buildings, and they were old and decrepit. I do remember that there was a latrine for waste, human waste, that was just outside the dorm window that was open, and just the conditions were horrible.
That was Denny's first glimpse of Mount Meigs, a place he eventually drove hundreds of kids to, a place he would come to call a slave camp. I'm Josie Duffy Rice, and this is Unreformed, the story of the Alabama Industrial School for Negro Children. Episode 2, The Arrival. If you were a kid in 1960s Alabama, and you were accused of breaking the law in some way, one of two things would probably happen. If you were white and had the money and resources, you'd probably get to go home. No charges, no punishment. But if you were one of the unlucky ones, you were sent to one of three industrial schools. There were two near Birmingham, one for white boys and one for white girls. But all the black kids, boys and girls, were sent to the Alabama Industrial School for Negro Children, otherwise known as Mount Meigs. And in some cases, you could be sent to Mount Meigs even when it wasn't clear that you'd broken any law.
If they ran away from home, the juvenile court would exercise jurisdiction. If they were incorrigible, if they didn't listen to their parents, they could be sent to the juvenile court.
That's Barry Feld. He's a centennial professor of law emeritus at the University of Minnesota Law School.
In addition, the children who were abused or neglected or dependent through no fault of their own, but because of their family circumstances, would also end up in juvenile court.
Some of these kids were sentenced to time at Mount Meigs, but other kids, they didn't even see a judge. They just got sent straight there. No formal charges, no clear sentence.
Once we got into the judge's chamber, he said, "Ma'am, I'm sentencing you 1 year and 6 months to the Mount Meigs Industrial School, huh? What? Why? What'd I do? You know, I didn't do anything." And I just cried and cried and cried and cried because I didn't understand. I didn't know.
That's Jenny Knox. Jenny was born in October 1952. She adored her mother, but Leona Montgomery had her challenges. She had many children, some of whom Jenny had no connection to. Mostly, Jenny had a relationship with her older sisters, Geraldine and Ernestine, who were close in age to her. She lived with the two of them, her mother, her three younger half-siblings, and their father, John Montgomery Sr., the only father that Jenny ever knew. Life with John as their father was comfortable, and the family lived in a nice home.
We didn't have to worry too much about anything when she was married.
But when Jenny was a young girl, John Montgomery was shipped off for yet another military tour abroad, and she and her siblings lived alone with their mother, an alcoholic who struggled to parent. Something had to give.
She started drinking, and things started happening. I just say life started happening. In the process of life happening to her, it was at our expense as children.
When Jenny was around 12, she and her younger siblings were placed in a foster home, and then a different one, and then yet a different one. Eventually, Jenny's aunt, Willie G. Robinson, became their legal guardian. Being taken in by actual family seems like it would have been a relief, but Jenny hated living with Aunt Willie. She made them work in the fields picking peas and cotton. She isolated them from family and friends. She controlled every aspect of their lives.
I really didn't want to stay with her, you know, because I didn't feel like I was being treated right. As a matter of fact, I didn't feel like any of us was treated right.
So Jenny ran away. She left Aunt Willie's house with a single goal in mind.
I just wanted to be with my mom. Nothing else really mattered to me like being with my mom. There was nobody greater, you know, knew how to take care of me or love me like my mom.
Jenny ended up staying with another aunt who told Jenny she was welcome as long as she did her chores and went to school. The arrangement was working out well until one day, a school staff member came to Jenny's class and summoned her to the principal's office. Jenny was devastated when she saw who was waiting for her.
She was there. Oh my God.
It was Aunt Willie. Even though Jenny was consistently attending school, and even though she was much happier staying with her other aunt, the judge ruled that Jenny running away from her appointed guardian, Aunt Willie, was an offense punishable by time served at Mount Meigs.
I wasn't out drinking, getting drunk, being loose in the streets or whatever. I had class, you know, anything about no boyfriend and all that different kind of stuff. But I didn't understand. It still bothers me, y'all.
So when Jenny was around 13, she was sentenced to 18 months at Mount Meigs. If you're wondering why these kids didn't push back or appeal their sentences, the answer is that they couldn't. Not back then, at least. They weren't entitled to lawyers. Children didn't really have any legal rights at all. Until just 55 years ago, American kids were being carted off to juvenile detention without first being afforded any procedural rights. Rights that, for kids like Jenny Knox, could have made a huge difference.
I didn't have a lawyer. I didn't know anything about a lawyer. I didn't know I needed one.
I was a ward of the state. Department of Children's Services had taken us from my mom several times. My mom was still having children.
Mary Stevens, who we met in her garden in episode one, has a similar story to Jenny.
My mom was needing me to work, help pick cotton and stuff for her to feed the children. I had to do that, so I was missing so many days of school and stuff and having to work that it just got to where I didn't want to go to school anymore because I was so far behind in everything. You know, I just didn't want to go.
Eventually, not going to school led to serious consequences.
We moved to Scottsboro, Alabama, where I had skipped school one day, and I got caught by a truancy. I went to juvenile. Somehow they decided that I was going to go to Montgomery, and I didn't know where I was going at the time.
In fact, Mary thought this move to Montgomery might be good news. She thought she might be getting a family again.
I thought I was going to be adopted because one of my brothers was adopted.
In 1967, at age 13, Mary was sent to Mount Meigs for truancy. This is part of the story that haunts me. Like Jenny and Lonnie, all Mary really wanted was her mother. And instead, she was functionally sent to a juvenile prison, a place where love and care were absent.
I believe I'll go back home. I believe I'll go back home. I believe I'll go back home.
Across Alabama, Mount Meigs was used as a boogeyman, essentially to scare kids into good behavior.
They say, you keep being bad, you're going to Mount Meigs.
That's Johnny Bodley, who you met in episode one. He's the professional musician who lives in Selma. Growing up, Johnny heard stories about Mount Meigs firsthand from his sister, who also went there. But her horror stories about the place weren't enough to keep Johnny out of there himself. Back then, when the local paper mentioned Mount Meigs, it was always because of a kid who was sent there after committing a more serious crime. Lots of stories about theft and even some kids accused of attempted rape or assault. The paper only ever mentioned those small minority of kids. But like Lonnie, Mary, and Jenny, there were many more kids who were sent to Mount Meigs for tiny infractions, or really for being poor and Black. But of the four of them, Johnny might be the closest to what the system would consider a quote-unquote delinquent today. He was caught by the police in 1967.
I had sat in the city jail for 3 months, and they shipped me to Mount Meigs on July 22nd, my 15th birthday.
Johnny, Lonnie, Mary, and Jenny, and everyone who came to Mount Meigs, got there the same way, driving down a long road that led to the school. Everyone we talked to remembered that drive and how they had no idea what awaited them.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Are you ready to take charge of your health journey? Look no further than Trinity School of Natural Health. With their flexible online programs, you can receive the comprehensive education you need to care for your loved ones or step into the thriving field of natural health. Why choose Trinity? Because their programs offer more than just coursework. You'll interact with experienced instructors, connect with like-minded peers, and even participate in optional live events to hone your skills. If you've ever thought about becoming a certified natural health professional, the CNHP program at Trinity School of Natural Health is the perfect certification course. You'll equip yourself with the knowledge and skills to make a real difference in the lives of others. Turn your passion for natural health into a rewarding career. Visit trinityschool.org today to learn more about the Certified Natural Health Professional Certification Program. Go to trinityschool.org. That's trinityschool.org. Trinity School of Natural Health. Transform your life. Transform the world.
Hey, it's me, Blippi, and this is my best friend, Mika.
Hi, I'm Mika, and this is our brand new podcast,
Blippi and Mika's Road Trip. The Blippi-mobile will take us to amazing places.
Click, click, put your seatbelts on. Get ready for a ride. We're gonna have some fun.
We'll explore and listen to the sounds of awesome places like farms, racetracks, and even construction sites.
Follow your ears, what do you hear?
And we'll meet new friends along the way.
They'll teach us awesome new things about the places and things we see and hear.
What did we learn today?
Learning is so cool.
Listen to Blippi and Mika's Road Trip Podcasts on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Mount Meigs is about 20 miles east of Montgomery and 2 hours south of Birmingham. In the 1960s, the kids were driven there by a juvenile probation officer, someone like Denny. And often, they were handcuffed in the back of the car. Lonnie, who came from Birmingham, probably took the newly constructed State Highway 65, which follows the Coosa River. On the edge of the highway, there were farmhouses and fields rolling by. Depending on where they were coming from, it could take hours to get there, heading away from the life they knew with no idea what awaited them. But eventually, they'd reach the road to Mount Meigs.
It was scary just to go down that road.
Then you ride slowly down this two-lane street, pear trees on both sides. You're riding slowly. None of us know where we was going.
The gate, first of all, taking that long ride to Mount Meigs, you're nervous. You don't know what to expect. Your mind running crazy or whatever.
You see this big old white house, which is the girls' home.
It's this big building with a big long front porch. It was a pretty building, but it looked kind of like a plantation house.
And then when you get on up to the building, you see young ladies out in the field, open field, and they was literally bent over, you know, with their hands pulling grass. And that let me know this is a horrible place.
The boys' side was farther on down the road from us.
We go through this gate where the gatekeeper were. Vehicle stopped. He gives him, write him in and sign him in. Then we move slowly on down that road. Then you start seeing all of these cottages, these brick buildings with bars and things on the windows.
Just awful looking buildings, lockup buildings, cottage C, cottage A, cottage D. I seen all these boys just out on the yard, just walking around, just doing nothing. You know, all of them look deadly, all of them look mean.
I remember the rock pile.
It's awful. I mean, it's like in this big yard and all of this dirt and all these big square rocks painted white.
The pile of white rocks looked ominous. A dramatic but kind of curious centerpiece on the flat pastoral landscape that Lonnie and Johnny came to understand all too well. When Lonnie arrived, the car pulled up to this old big house on the campus. And out came the superintendent, Elias Brown Holloway, otherwise known as E.B.
Mr. Holloway came out, and he was huge and big, and he would stand up and look at all of us, and then from that, he tells us about the place and tells us that we should never try to run away. There is no escaping now.
Lonnie still shudders at the memory of Holloway. You may remember that just days before this, Lonnie and some other boys had tried to escape from a Birmingham jail. But the minute he saw Holloway, he knew that escaping from this place would be much harder.
Lord have mercy.
After arriving, boys were given standard-issue military fatigues. This was the only clothing that they had. It's the same thing that Denny saw the kids wearing when he showed up to Mount Meigs for the first time.
You take off all your civilian clothes, you turn them in, you turn in any properties or anything you had in your pockets.
The campus had several buildings, a chapel, a barn, a cannery, a nurse's station that was almost always empty, and a schoolroom that a lot of kids never saw the inside of. The boys slept in buildings called cottages. Johnny was at first assigned to Cottage D, a residence known for being on lockdown 24 hours a day. The cottages were overseen by counselors, and during Lonnie's time at Mount Meigs, he remembers one of the counselors supervising his cottage had been convicted of serious violent crimes. And the cottages were packed full of kids. In some years, three kids slept on one cot. The barely stuffed mattresses reeked of urine. The conditions and facilities were disgusting to the point of hazardous. Mount Meigs was virtually unlivable. There was an open sewer full of feces and trash that became a cesspool for mosquitoes. The outhouse was just a long board with multiple holes cut out of it. And the buildings, dilapidated and poorly constructed, were extreme fire hazards. For at least one stretch of time, there was no clean water at the facility at all. The kids never had enough to eat, and what they had was barely edible. After all, the kitchen was full of roaches and other vermin. But they were so hungry they'd eat anything. In one story, when a kid vomited all over his food, another boy was so hungry that he ate it. One survivor said he often saw boys pick corn out of cow manure to eat. The kids were assigned jobs, manual labor that they had to do to maintain the Mount Meigs campus. There were chores like working in the kitchen or milking the 35 cows. But all of them were expected to work in the fields. Mount Meigs was surrounded by miles of farmland. There were 1,500 acres. They were filled with fruit trees, row upon row of vegetables, but mostly cotton.
It looked just like slavery time. I mean, they would line us up in the morning. All the boys would have to hold their hoes up in the air. And when we get ready to go, the overseer would say, chop down. And all of these boys would march to a field about 5, 6, 7 miles away to work. Sometimes they ran to the field.
Every day, from dawn until dusk, there they were, black children, out in the Alabama fields, picking cotton. These kids were being worked to the absolute bone. These were kids usually from cities like Birmingham or Montgomery. They were told this was training, but training for what? And even for the kids that did have farming experience, it was close to impossible to pick that much cotton every single day.
When I first got there, I didn't know nothing about picking cotton. I just pulled the whole stalk and everything.
After filling up large sacks with cotton, a truck would drive by with a weigh station, making sure that the kids had met their quotas. One time, Lonnie and some other boys tried to outsmart the scale by adding stones to the bottom of the bag.
It was stupid for us to do that.
That led to serious punishment. Punishment that the kids at Mount Meigs were all too familiar with.
If you didn't pick 100 pounds of cotton a day, I don't care how old you were, they would beat you. They would punish you. If you didn't pick a certain amount of watermelons, if you didn't pick a certain amount of cucumbers in Mount Meigs, they would punish you. If you was running to the field and you got sick, they would punish you for that.
Quote-unquote discipline at Mount Meigs was relentless. And you could get punished for almost nothing or for things completely out of your control. Like this one time that Johnny and some other boys were riding in the front seat of a truck out to the fields. When the driver of the car suddenly slammed on the brakes, the boys were thrown forward and the windshield was shattered.
And Mr. Glover took each boy down out of the truck and beat him right there as if it was our fault.
Mr. Glover was the man who oversaw the boys' work, watching their every move in the fields.
Mr. Glover was an older man. Whatever part of the military that he was in had lamed him because he mostly sat down everywhere he went.
Despite his disability, Mr. Glover had a reputation for beating kids with a particular intensity.
John Henry. Yeah. But that's the name of his stick.
And John Henry the Oak Stick isn't Mr. Glover's only signature.
Mr. Glover usually sit in his chair and beat you. And you down here on the ground, he would beat you while he's sitting in his chair.
For the boys who fail to complete all their cotton picking on his watch, Mr. Glover has an especially disturbing punishment.
He would take his oak stick and drill a hole in the ground. And he would say, "You see that hole in the ground, boy?" And you would have to say, "Yes, sir, Mr. Glover." He would say, "Put your private part in it.
Put your dick in the hole, not literally pull yourself out your clothes, but that's where you lay on top of that hole." And he began to whoop you. Every time he whoop you, he hit you, and then he'll grunt with the stick. And then he'll keep on hitting you with the stick each time, and he grunt.
And your thighs swell up. And pretty soon you're walking with a limp. That's just how bad Mount Meigs was.
There were a number of other adults who ran the facility in the 1960s. Mr. Reddy was another infamous punisher.
Mr. Reddy, he was a shell-shocked person. Man, he was wild.
And we call him Wild Child.
Like, God damn it, he would cuss all the time. If he caught you doing something, God damn it, you want to be a fucking bully, don't you? And he'll run over and just start beating on you and beat on you and beat on you and beat on you until he felt that he was satisfied.
But it wasn't just the staff that the boys had to look out for. In an essay about his experience at Mount Meigs, Johnny wrote that on the first night there, he stayed awake until morning for fear of being sexually assaulted. And not just by the staff, but by the other boys.
You know, all of them look deadly, all of them trying to put fear in you.
For Johnny, it's impossible to talk about Mount Meigs without touching upon the rampant sexual abuse that openly took place.
I mean, boys got raped all the time in Mount Meigs.
And if a boy reported to a counselor that they'd been assaulted, nothing happened.
So if a boy tell them that they got raped, they wouldn't do nothing about that.
Boys would often stick together in groups based on where they were from. All the Birmingham boys together, Montgomery boys. When Johnny was there, there were just a couple other boys from Selma. And Johnny quickly learned that even among those groups, there were divisions.
There were guys known as Scrubs, and there were guys known as Ikes. Ikes were tough. Scrubs were sort of like suckers.
Many of the Ikes become charge boys, meaning it becomes their job to keep their peers in line. But even though they're all the same age, the charge boys have a lot of power over the others.
All they had to say was that you left some cotton on your rope, and they would take you up to the overseer, Mr. Glover.
The other thing about Mount Meigs is that it was a school without any schooling. None of the boys can recount getting a real education there or taking any real classes. It was a labor farm, basically. The girls, they seemed to have some instruction, but not much.
Miss Alexander was our weekend night supervisor. I think Harris was our sewing teacher. Ms. Wright for cosmetology. Mr. Dubose was over the field.
That was Jenny. You can hear just how worked up she is, even when she's just talking about who was on staff. It's still difficult for her to talk about Mount Meigs. As she recalled her experience there, she cried and cried. When Jenny first arrived, she was taken to the dining hall.
Everybody gathered around the wall. They introduced me to the staffs and the ladies, and they make you undress in front of everybody.
The staff forced the new girls to bend over, naked, and spread their legs for inspection. They said it was for safety, but the girls suspected the real reason was humiliation, to make sure that they knew their place.
It affects your privacy. It degrading.
Nothing like this had ever happened to Jenny before. And even now, 60 years later, it still haunts her. And that was just day one. It was only the beginning. On the girls' side, they all slept in one dormitory, that big white building that looked like a plantation house. You can't talk about Mount Meigs in the 1960s without talking about Fannie B. Matthews, the girls' matron. When Mary first arrived at Mount Meigs, though, she thought she was safe.
I was relieved because everybody was my complexion and, you know, I thought it was going to be okay.
Everyone who worked or was locked up at Mount Meigs was Black. When she first arrived, this provided a false sense of security to Mary, and she thought she'd been brought to Mount Meigs to be adopted.
And when we got there in the driveway, I went in, met by Fannie B. Matthews, and she greeted me, and I asked her, I said, are you going to adopt me? I did. I was there to be adopted. I didn't know.
But Fannie Matthews was no mother to those girls. Mrs. Matthews was a tall, middle-aged Black woman who wore a wavy, cropped salt-and-pepper wig. She was the mastermind of the complex system of psychological and physical punishments she and her staff doled out to the girls.
She had a very strong voice, very strong voice. She didn't have to raise it. She was loud.
Her demeanor, voice, and facial expressions, and her walk was fierce. And she always carried a thick Greek wooden paddle in her hand. And she would carry that paddle and a baton in her purse on her shoulder.
The paddle was a constant threat, a reminder that Fannie Matthews would not hesitate to beat any student.
And I've gotten hit in the head by Ms. Matthews several times with this baton. Bend over and give her a real hump in your back. Touch her toes. And she comes down on your back as hard as she can, with every ounce of strength in her. And when she do, it feels like you just went through a shock treatment because it hurts that bad and it feels like you're going through the floor when she hits you like that.
Fannie Matthews was relentless. If she heard any girls making noise at night, she'd line up everyone in the hallway, going down the line and hitting girls in the head with that baton. As a punishment, Jenny had to manually dry clothes and sheets, meaning she had to stand up all night and shake them dry. Mostly, Mount Meigs was a torture site, a place where children just endured unbelievable abuse. But there were some good moments. Some moments when the kids could feel like they were actual children and not inmates. There were a couple of extracurricular activities that Jenny got involved in.
I did become a part of the choir. Out there, I became a cheerleader while I was out there.
She even met a boy, nicknamed Chick. Chick was 15 years old when he and Jenny met at Mount Meigs. He was serving time down the road on the boys' side, and on the rare occasion that it was his job to drive the tractor near the fields where the girls lived, he would get a chance to see them.
I think Chick used to always come to the girls' home and you know, drive the tractors. And, you know, I guess he got turned on by seeing me and wanted to know who I were.
Their courtship was sweet, innocent.
We just slipped letters to one another. And if we was caught slipping letters to each other, we would get in trouble.
But these few opportunities to be normal American teenagers were brief.
There were some good things that went on. They didn't last long, but there were some good things that went on. I was in the choir, you know, I was on the football team. I was a kitchen boy, worked in the kitchen. And all of those things were privileged positions, you know. But as I said, it was very brutal. And if you made it out alive, you was blessed.
You may be wondering how anyone got out of Mount Meigs alive. And the truth is that many didn't, or at least that's the consensus. We don't have records that tell us just how many kids died because of abuse or starvation or being worked to death. But there were kids who disappeared, and there are memories of children who were beaten within an inch of their life and then never seen again.
And that happened a couple of times. We know that they must have had to die. There ain't no ambulance came down through there.
Some even have memories of a makeshift graveyard.
When you arrive in Mount Meigs, you'll see these graves over to the side, and you don't know what's up. But a lot of boys didn't even make it out of Mount Meigs.
And they said that was not such a graveyard. But I think that was a cover-up. Because there must have been.
And of course, all of this, the beatings, the abuse, the sexual assault, the cotton quotas, the strip search, the starvation, the deaths, the graveyard, the infinite, never-ending punishments, were condoned, if not outright encouraged, by the school superintendent, E.B. Holloway.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Are you ready to take charge of your health journey? Look no further than Trinity School of Natural Health. With their flexible online programs, you can receive the comprehensive education you need to care for your loved ones or step into the thriving field of natural health. Why choose Trinity? Because their programs offer more than just coursework. You'll interact with experienced instructors, connect with like-minded peers, and even participate in optional live events to hone your skills. If you've ever thought about becoming a certified natural health professional, the CNHP program at Trinity School of Natural Health is the perfect certification course. You'll equip yourself with the knowledge and skills to make a real difference in the lives of others. Turn your passion for natural health into a rewarding career. Visit trinityschool.org today to learn more about the Certified Natural Health Professional Certification Program. Go to trinityschool.org. That's trinityschool.org. Trinity School of Natural Health. Transform your life. Transform the world.
Hey, it's me, Blippi, and this is my best friend, Mika.
Hi, I'm Mika, and this is our brand new podcast,
Blippi and Mika's Road Trip. The Blippi-mobile will take us to amazing places.
Click, click, put your seatbelts on, get ready for a ride. We're gonna have some fun.
We'll explore and listen to the sounds of awesome places like farms, racetracks, and even construction sites.
Follow your ears, what do you hear?
And we'll meet new friends along the way.
They'll teach us awesome new things about the places and things we see and hear.
What did we learn today?
Learning is so cool.
Listen to Blippi and Mika's Road Trip Podcasts on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
you can't talk about Mount Meigs in the 1960s without talking about E.B. Holloway. For 18 years, he ran the institution, and of all the adults who were directly responsible for what those children endured, as the superintendent, Holloway was arguably the most to blame.
He was staying in the best house in Mount Meigs, so he was treated like a king. You know, had the girls come down and do all of the housework and stuff like that. He was almost like the master of the plantation.
There's one specific and chilling detail that stays with Johnny about Holloway, even now.
You know, he lined everybody up, and he always smiled. He'll be beating you to death, and he'd be smiling.
I keep thinking about the adults who were running the school back then. Mr. Glover, Mr. Reddy, Fanny Matthews, and especially E.B. Holloway. Who were they, and why did they treat these kids, these children who were in their care, so violently? The truth is, we don't know too much about what was going on internally at Mount Meigs back then. We searched state archives and people's personal documents. We sent in public records requests. But we haven't found or received any personnel records. But what we do know is that no one really seemed to be penalized for what was going on. The Department of Social Welfare and the Department of Pensions in Alabama, they did these annual reports. Every year they came to the school and they examined the grounds and they typed up these perfunctory reports that are basically the same every year. And they just don't mention the violence that these kids were enduring. And the couple of times that it is, like, alluded to, it's framed as fair punishment. It's framed as reasonable. And it wasn't just that Holloway faced no backlash. It was also that he was celebrated. He was praised across the state. In fact, if you judged Holloway based on what was written about him in the newspapers, you would honestly think this guy was a hero, a champion for kids fighting tooth and nail to secure adequate resources and funding for them from the state of Alabama. And this is an important thing to keep in mind here, too, because it wasn't just the abuse that was the problem. Some of Mount Meigs' problems couldn't have been solved even if they had had the best staff in the world. It was a chronically underfunded school. It won't be surprising to know that the white industrial schools in Alabama had far higher budgets while housing fewer kids. And at Mount Meigs, you know, there was this double standard. A judge in the 1950s said that he did not want to approve more money for Mount Meigs because they could just sell the crops they grew to fund themselves. At the white schools, no one was telling them to make their own money off of crop yield. But at Mount Meigs, the state just kind of expected the black people to make it work. Here's the other thing about E.B. Holloway. He was technically never qualified to run Mount Meigs. He had no real background as an educator, had never worked at a school like this. So why did the state of Alabama hire him? Holloway was born in 1906 in South Carolina. He moved to Alabama to attend the Tuskegee Institute, founded by Booker T. Washington, an institution that becomes an important part of our story. We'll get to that next episode. Holloway went into agriculture, not education, but he started gunning for the job at Mount Meigs in 1944, before the previous superintendent, J.R. Wingfield, had even retired. Wingfield spent 27 years on the job and was a prominent black figure in the community, considered part of the upper echelon of black society. Starting before Wingfield even retired, Holloway wrote letters to the governor asking for the job. And then the governor quickly received a flurry of other letters from Alabamians recommending Holloway for the position, including from white men, some of whom Holloway barely knew. It became clear that he was asking anyone he could to recommend him, despite not being qualified for the role. But even with all those recommendations, Holloway didn't get the job. The governor appointed as superintendent another black man with more experience named Amos Parker. Holloway, instead, was hired to oversee the agriculture at Mount Meigs. But Holloway didn't give up. He still wanted to be superintendent and seemed willing to sabotage Parker in order to get the job. In 1951, 5 years later, the governor got another letter about Mount Meigs, this time from a White County judge. The judge asked that Amos Parker be replaced as superintendent because of the hotbed of Negro political activity in Montgomery. The judge insisted in his letter that Parker belonged to the radical element that is causing much trouble through agitation, unrest, and scheming. The judge recommended Holloway as Parker's replacement because, in the judge's own writing, Mount Meigs is in great need of some white oversight. And Holloway seems to be a good Negro. He is educated and doesn't dabble in political activities. The governor wrote back and said that the judge had bad information, that Parker didn't have radical tendencies. And it was true that, as far as we know, Parker wasn't particularly radical. But he was more willing to speak out about what Mount Meigs needed. In March of 1951, he went to the state legislature and he told them that the conditions at the school were deplorable. He said the kids were using fertilizer sacks for towels and that many of them didn't even have shoes. It's not radical to say that kids should have shoes to wear, but it was bold. It made the news. And eventually, the governor decided that Parker was more trouble than he was worth. In 1952, it became official. The governor fired Parker and made E.B. Holloway the new superintendent of Mount Meigs. Every superintendent up until and including Holloway was Black. In fact, Mount Meigs was operated exclusively by Black people. For a long time, that was mandated by law. Black children were not allowed to be taught by white teachers. But even after the law changed, the pattern continued. Still, state officials were specific about what kind of Black people they wanted in the job. It seemed the state of Alabama preferred staff members who were ambivalent to the Black quote-unquote cause.
Well, Tim can't read, Tim can't write, Tim can't tell you from a track line right. Oh boy, little line, it's da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Oh boy, little line, it's da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
By the time Denny Abbott started working as a juvenile probation officer in 1961, it was clear that Holloway's allegiance wasn't to the kids, but to the white board members.
He would do whatever the white authorities or those board of trustees told him to do. They raised some pigs and other chickens and things like that at Mount Meigs. And so when they slaughtered them for the meat, guess what happened? The white trustees pulled up in their brand new cars and all of the meat was put into the trunks of their cars and they left and the kids had nothing.
Alabama.
And Denny says that despite Mount Meigs' charter that saved three seats on the board for Black people, all the trustees in the 1960s were white, save for one, Holloway. And many of the board members had land surrounding Mount Meigs. So when it came time to get their crops harvested, guess who did the work?
They would pick up the phone and call the superintendent, and the superintendent would send the kids over there in a truck. Did they get any compensation for that? No. All they got was beatings when they didn't do enough work or the overseers didn't think they picked enough cotton, and they were physically beaten every day in the field. So I don't know how much more you could describe a slave camp than that.
Cam can't read and Cam can't ride. Cam can't tell you when the track line ride. Big boy, shake it over.
In some ways, 1960s Mount Meigs was like an early prototype of the for-profit prison. But it certainly wasn't designed that way. When a Black woman and student of Booker T. Washington named Cornelia Bowen founded Mount Meigs in 1908, she envisioned a safe haven for Black kids who weren't being served by the state of Alabama. She believed in reform through industrial education. And often, she was successful. And without her, America might not have had one of its most legendary Black athletes, baseball player Satchel Paige. That's next time on Unreformed. Unreformed, the story of the Alabama Industrial School for Negro Children, is a production of School of Humans and iHeartMedia. This episode was written by me, Josie Duffy Rice, and Taylor Von Leslie. Our script supervisor is Florence Burrow Adams, and our producer is Gabby Watts. We had additional writing and production support from Sherry Scott. Executive producers are Virginia Prescott, Elsie Crowley, Brandon Barr, Matt Arnett, and me. Sound design and mix is by Jesse Neiswanger. Music is by Ben Soli. Additional recordings are courtesy of the Alabama Center for Traditional Culture. The songs featured in this episode are from Vera Hall, Mary Lee Bindolf with S.E.B. Petway, and Richard Amerson. Special thanks to the Alabama Department of Archives and History, Michael Harriet, Floyd Hall, Kevin Nutt, Van Newkirk, and all of the survivors of Mount Meigs willing to share their stories. If you or someone you know attended Mount Meigs and would like to be in contact, please email mountmeigspodcast@gmail.com. That's M-T-M-E-I-G-S podcast@gmail.com.
School of Humans.
Are you ready to take charge of your health journey? Look no further than Trinity School of Natural Health. With their flexible online programs, you can receive the comprehensive education you need to care for your loved ones or step into the thriving field of natural health. Why choose Trinity? Because their programs offer more than just coursework. You'll interact with experienced instructors, connect with like-minded peers, and even participate in optional live events to hone your skills. If you've ever thought about becoming a certified natural health professional, the CNHP program at Trinity School of Natural Health is the perfect certification course. You'll equip yourself with the knowledge and skills to make a real difference in the lives of others. Turn your passion for natural health into a rewarding career. Visit trinityschool.org today to learn more about the Certified Natural Health Professional Certification Program. Go to trinityschool.org. That's trinityschool.org. Trinity School of Natural Health. Transform your life. Transform the world.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta.
Right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars for the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
Hey, it's me, Blippi, and this is my best friend, Mika.
Hi, I'm Mika, and this is our brand new podcast,
Blippi and Mika's Road Trip. The Blippi-mobile will take us to amazing places.
And we'll meet new friends along the way.
Listen to Blippi and Mika's Road Trip podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.